So just to quickly, just to a brief summary of the presentations that we had this afternoon in our final session. Arlette spoke about basically the social capital and the importance in transferring or learning how maybe transferring on agricultural innovation and how that has to be incorporated into solving food security problems. Ramesh spoke about looking at basically the importance of looking at alternative grains, not focusing so much on corn and wheat and rice, although extremely important. We have the, what I think they call them, the orphan crops that are equally important to local populations and should be looked at and have proven to be successful. Verena talked about organic farming and how that could be a possible way of improving agricultural systems, especially with subsistence systems where it's hard to get direct inputs. And Tracy and Nadia looked at evaluation systems for malnutrition, and this would be used in emergency situations where it is important to have valid data so people, aid agencies and so forth, know how and what they should be supplying. So I'd like to open up the floor to questions. These are students working in the field, doing things, and I would just ask you to identify yourself before asking the question.
Hi, thank you for the presentations. I have a question for Tracy and Nadia about the SMART methodology, which I can see huge value in assessing a situation that has already deteriorated a long way. But it seems that the types of indicators you'd be picking up do take some time to develop, and I wonder if there's thought given to how long that lag is and whether there is need to be able to pick up using some other methodology, pick up the situation before it has gotten quite that dire.
Well, the SMART methodology process can be used at multiple points in time for a region, and that's called surveillance. So through that system, you can detect an increase in the malnutrition rate, and therefore you can intervene earlier before it becomes more severe. Does that answer your question?
Partially, but this still takes time to develop. It takes weeks or months for the types of indicators that you're talking about to change. So, you know, by that time, there's been a lot of damage done, and this would be particularly true in a more of a crisis situation than a long-term monitoring situation. But even long-term monitoring, by the time you see that happen, yes, it's important to know it then, but it would have been nice to know it a year earlier.
Right. No, I understand better now. There is a rapid assessment procedure that NGOs will carry out. So SMART is more of it's used to gather more valid, reliable information on a greater scale, essentially.
Hi, Joanne Gaskell from University of California, Berkeley. Again, this question is sort of a challenge to Verena, but maybe everyone has comments. And I would, I guess, question the extrapolation of the results, your results on organic agriculture from developed countries to a developing country setting. For example, if developing country organic farmers are organic out of choice and more out of necessity, maybe their farming systems are not more diversified. I mean, maybe they're essentially the same except without the access to synthetic fertilizers, in which case, if those organic farmers in developing countries are really the most poor farmers, maybe the least connected to markets, maybe with sort of lower levels of education, then you might expect the yield gaps or the yield differences for organic versus conventional to be even greater in the developing country context. And so I wonder, A, if you would agree with that hypothesis that the yield difference might be even greater if you compare within developing countries. And then secondly, if that's true, if the yield gap is even sort of, if losses might be even greater than 25%, and if you could connect those farmers to markets, wouldn't you want to offer them access to fertilizers instead of access to a European export market, for example?
So I think you raise a really important question, because In this debate about organic agriculture, there is a lot of issues about what we are actually talking about. And I think it's very important that if we use the term organic agriculture, that we stick to organic agriculture as it is defined in policies and in regulations, which means that is a purposeful management method. And if we define organic agriculture like this, organic agriculture is more than simply not using any chemical inputs. It implies that you need to use a more diverse cropping system, that you need to have enhanced crop rotations, that you need to use biological pest control and such things. So I would not call farming systems in developing countries that do not use chemical pesticides or chemical fertilizers organic. There are simply no input systems, but not organic systems.
Just quick follow-up. Is that still true then that 3/4 of the world's organic farmers are in developing countries, given
yes.
that definition?
Well, yes. Yeah, because it's just that the number of farmers is much larger in developing countries. In developed countries, there are fewer farmers that produce more food per farmer. And so you have a lot of small producers in organic in developing countries that produce organic food. And so regarding the yield gap between organic and conventional agriculture in developing countries, I think there is some evidence that suggests that sustainable intensification methods like the use of green manures or like the use of composting methods, that they can increase the yields compared to these no-input systems. Because, of course, if you add any inputs, no matter whether they're chemical or organic, you would increase yields. But the problem is that we have no long-term controlled, well-controlled and well-designed studies that examine the yields in true organic systems and compared to small-scale subsistence farming systems. So there is no conclusive evidence on the yield gap in these type of comparisons yet, unfortunately.
Well, I am to add only. This is about the millets and the nutrition both. I am to tell you that the millets are ecological crops. They should be placed as ecological crops, and every given reason there has been a millet. But in course of time, the irrigation has replaced them with the elite class crop, that is wheat and a paddy. But truly speaking, and I am offering you a research point too, I have come from the mountain Himalayas. We grow buckwheat, and buckwheat has a content which prevents the solar radiation hazard. What I am trying to point out, every given reason, there is definitely a physiological matching what the region grow. And unfortunately, we have broken it with a different crop system and research that we have undertaken. Second important is, if you look into whole nutritional deficit, we are now by... It is mainly because the food habit have changed a lot. What we used to eat earlier and which was truly matching to the climate we are born with, it has totally changed. That's a very, very important, because I am to give an idea that we are in a place, we had a dependence not on the crop, within the crop, the millets and so on, and also we had a dependence on wild fruits and the wild resources, and that used to meet our nutritional needs. Therefore, what I'm feeling, and this is most important, definitely these ecological crops, which does not labor intensive, does not need a lot of fertilization, these ecological crops are going to be the most important, and the value additions, because bringing them a new flavor with the market, nutritional crops, nutritional products, will definitely have a very good market too. And these crop systems can only help to combat nutritional deficiency that we are facing today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. I would like to make some comments on that. Why the millets lost in our food system is because of the lack of the technological, which I believe is a post-harvest technological stuffs. So that's why the wheat and rice took the place of the millet, because I grew up when I was a kid eating by millets. But when I, at the age of 20, I'm not able to find the millets in the market. So it's lack of the technologies and lack of the extension work. It's also the lack of the the nutritional awareness of the millets. Thank you.
Can I ask another question about millet?
Yes.
About what the global market is like for millet, if there is one at all. Is there any international trade in it? And if there is any trade in it, how does that affect the incentives and the market in domestically in India?
Could you please identify yourself?
Sorry, my name is Liam Plevin. I'm a reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you very much for your question. If you take a look at the millet production, it's just like 26 million tons in our total world. But if you compare with the wheat, it's around more than 800 million tons, I believe. So I don't think there is much export and import of the millets. It's usually the millets cultivated and consumed within a country. And it really depends in future how much we are going to produce. So. In the sense the production is, the production of the millets is not much comparable with wheat. So there's no the data is available as the price is going up or not.
Hi, Dara from University of Ottawa again. My question is for Verena. I was wondering if in your studies you came across, I've read several reports and studies on alternative methods of agriculture, not necessarily organic or non-organic, but crop rotation, animal and crop rotation and stuff like that, that yields higher amounts of produce and than traditional forms of agriculture or organic forms of agriculture of the monocrop variety. Did you come across studies like this, and where do they fit into your research?
Yeah, so there is a large body of literature that hypothesizes exactly this, that agroecological methods could lead to yield increases in small-scale farming systems in developing countries. But the problem is, on one hand, that a lot of this evidence is anecdotal evidence that comes from case studies, but it doesn't come from well-designed scientific research. And so that's one issue. And the other issue, that a lot of these studies, they, as you say, they examine agroecological methods. So, for example, the system of rice intensification would fall under that category. But they do allow the use of chemical inputs, so they're not organic. So that's why we had to leave them out, because they are not truly purposefully organic.
Do you think there's any possibility of creating large-scale versions of those smaller farms, or do you think that's completely impossible? Would you end up having to have basically a whole bunch of small-scale farms stuck together as one big farm, just out of curiosity?
I think if you want to scale up organic agriculture, you have two main problems. One is labor, that organic agriculture typically requires increased labor. And in some developing countries, that is a good factor because it creates employment in rural areas. But in other developing countries, there is a labor shortage even today for farm labor. So organic agriculture, scaling up organic agriculture in these areas might be more problematic. And the other issue is organic nutrient inputs, because organic agriculture doesn't use chemical fertilizers, but it still depends on nutrient inputs for high yield performance. And in many developing countries, animal manure is used for other purposes, so it can be applied to farming systems. Or there is not sufficient organic waste that could be used to develop compost, or there is not the knowledge to create good quality compost. So I think those are two issues that would have to be addressed, and where I think we can try to identify regions that have a high labor availability and a high organic input availability, maybe focus on those areas and see how, wherever we can scale up organic agriculture.
Thank you for your the impressive presentation. I think that one common issue which joined all your report, it is a need social mobilization. Unfortunately, this factor is not proper under assess in the present situation, but the vulnerability of change in the food market, in the weather situation, in the climate change, cause that needs for farmer to stress again development of the extension service, in which one from the principal role will play social mobilizer. We met with this situation in the Central Asia and in the new created water user association, we tried to include this social mobilization. But maybe this line of actions should be stressed on all global world, because the farmer under the unpredictable situation in which they need help, assistance, and advice. Thank you.
I just wanted to respond to that comment. I think it is very important that we appreciate that the amount of change that is involved in social ecological systems, that we do need to have a better understanding of how things happen and how the actors within that system operate. And at this time, a lot of the time we have assumptions and we need more empirical data to understand how they're operating within their system. What are the contexts within which they do make decisions so we can better make responsive and integrative policy. So we have the problem of assuming things. I think somebody spoke about scientific sovereignty. We're making assumptions, we're in settings divorced from those contexts, and we have certain perspectives and opinions. But there is in every context, people are making decisions and they're informed by particular perspectives. So we need to understand them so we can make decisions, so we can suggest or even suggest to them new ways in doing what they already do. Otherwise, we will meet some of these gaps in information. We have great science. I think Dr. Ferroni said the science exists to solve the world's hunger problems. But for 50% of the world are smallholder farmers. They need to understand in a way that meaningfully deals with their issues, what the technology can do, and they need the knowledge systems to help bring that into fruition. At this time, we are not necessarily speaking the same language. So understanding how their knowledge flows, how they do what they do, helps us better prepare these policies to meet them where they are and take them where they need to go in a sustainable, resilient way.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Vijaya Raghavan. I didn't do that last time when I was here. So I'm from Bioresource Engineering, McGill University. I have two questions, one on the social side and innovation. So first of all, I would like to congratulate all the speakers. It was very enjoyable on the very varied topics. And then in particular, the social aspects and the innovation, they are very fundamental, what goes on in a village setup. So I'm glad to see that it is going to be addressed in an organized fashion so that we can understand the factors involved to contribution towards innovation. And then we got to go a step further to make that and then give some case studies and make them all connected well. I'd just like to hear about those case studies aspect of it, if you can.
Okay. Currently a lot of extension in developed countries requires an extension officer to go to, as you could well imagine, let's say in the example of St. Lucia, there's about 10,000 smallholder farmers with a staff of, let's say, at the maximum 100 extension officers. So that one extension officer in maybe every month he's able to see once a month he's able to see a farmer. As you could well imagine, and as I described the system, they're working with diverse crops. They don't necessarily have great resources. There's a present need to deal with pests and different problems that they're meeting in producing. So one of the ways these knowledge networks develop is they're asking farmers who might be bigger than they are, who are more knowledgeable than they are, because they can't wait for the extension officer to come answer their question. So once we understand who are the focal farmers that farmers in a particular setting are dependent upon, or who are well located or situated to disseminate, diffuse innovations, then we know who are champions when we're entering with whatever the innovation that we are particularly focusing on, whether it's millet or cassava production. We have a strategic approach when we're entering a village. Right now, there seems to be the idea that whatever the technology is, the build and they will come. And we have seen, that's why resilience exists. The system is set up in a particular way and the farmers are operating and they do not necessarily require the inputs of other parties. So when we understand how the system operates, we are better able to go in, and I don't know if I quite answered your question.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I?
Yeah. Oh, do you mind?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
he can finish first.
Oh, you can finish first.
this is about more a comment than the question. Millet, the question came up about the export market and import. So India is one of the larger producers of millets, and then actually in the governmental policy issues, it was neglected because the certain part of the country, they were using millet, but they found out the younger generation, it's difficult to cook them at the kitchen stage. So therefore, it was easier to buy rice, and also the government policy is they were selling rice at a cheaper price. So therefore, they end up buying rice and then going away from millet. Then all the scientific studies has pointed out what we are losing in terms of its nutrition and also the glycemic index point of view. Then the government came up with the policy how to revitalize the millet production. Millet production, it is a crop which can grow with minimal water and poorer soil conditions. So that's a big advantage from many geographic region point of view. So therefore, once when you start bringing the economic costs, so millet is more expensive to buy. So the farmers, they know they produce millets, but they can get cheaper price rice. So they know that their economic condition is going to be better. So they actually end up selling them for a higher price. And then they buy, although they know that nutritionally it is better, but their economic situation points out that they have to do this marketability in that way. So now, that is the reason now, both from the IDRC point of view and the Indian government point of view, the millet has been focused in big time. Now, related to the export market, millet was not sold as a product by itself, but the components of it is being taken out and added value for other food products. So thereby, the value it is a kind of a trade secret, if you like. And then that way it is being sold. But as such, the millet export or import, that is not happening. But now, from the scientific community point of view, we're focusing on the millet characteristics. And then millet being small grain, handling them is one of the important issues. So therefore, the technological input has to come in, both from harvesting point of view, threshing point of view, and the dehulling, and then so on and so forth. So that is where this project has come up to address some of those issues. So thereby, the millet can be available in a pure form so that it can be marketable and then used in an effective fashion so that the society would benefit from the health perspective. That's where we are at. There is a lot of potential for the millet to grow. And of course, not only in India, but other parts of the world, it's being grown and then it is being focused on now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you want to comment?
Thank you very much, Professor Raghavan, for your valuable comment. I would like just want to mention that Professor Raghavan is active, involved in all the aspects of the project which I just presented. Thank you, sir.
My name is Michelle. I'm an undergrad student at Food Science at McGill. I have a question. It's about when you say sustainable organic culture, what do you mean what is the time that you aim for? Because if organic culture, they are in their developing countries, of course they can offer the laborers right now, but some countries are growing so fast that maybe the organic culture cannot catch up as fast as it can. Also, in terms of economic, organic culture, can it provide the food as low price as their normal culture, so that the people in their developing country, they can buy their food organic instead of non-organic? Thank you.
So regarding the labor availability, yeah, that's a very good point. We see increased urbanization in developing countries, so more and more people will move to urban areas and will give up farming jobs. On the other hand, I just learned a couple of days ago that the net population is still growing in rural areas because the proportion of urban people are increasing, but in total we still see a population growth. So at the moment we still there is still population growth even in rural areas in developing countries. So in the near future, I think that there is still a large labor pool that could be used to adopt organic methods. But in the long term, like say 50, 100 years or something, we might need to reevaluate this point. And your second point was regarding...
organic culture can offer the food as low prices to non-organic.
The prices, yeah. So I think that's very closely related to yields. At the moment, organic food is more expensive because we pay a price premium for the environmental services that we hope it will provide. So if we take into account the true cost of conventional agriculture, that's the common argument from the organic side, we would have to pay more for conventional food because it has all these negative impacts on the environment. That's on the one side. On the other hand, organic agriculture still has the potential to reduce the organic food, I think, and still has the potential to reduce prices in the future. On one hand, if we have more production, then prices will decrease. And on the other hand, also if yields increased in organic farming systems, then we would have decreased prices. And there is our yield study showed that organic yields can come quite close to conventional yields under some conditions. For example, when good management is applied under rainfed agriculture, it's more it performs better than in irrigated agriculture. And I think this shows that there is a big leeway for improvement of organic yields. Because most of agricultural research of the past and of the present has gone into conventional agriculture, while organic agriculture hasn't received a lot of research and research effort and research funding. And organic agriculture needs very different type of research than conventional agriculture. It needs different crops. Different crop varieties that are adapted to the specific conditions under organic management. It needs research on nutrient inputs and on crop rotations and biological pest control, which is a very, very complex process. So I think there is a big, if there is a big potential for further increasing organic yields if we put more, if we learn more about these management practices and if we manage the organic system as well, which could decrease the prices of organic food.
Do you think it's easier to apply organic culture to their already developed country because they have the management and they have the resource for the research? So
you are if it's easier to apply organic agriculture in developed countries?
Yeah.
Yes and no. On one hand, there are demand for organic food currently is in developed countries. So and also the sensibilization for organic agriculture, just the issues that organic agriculture stands for are more prevalent in developed countries. But on the other hand, in developing countries, a lot of small-scale farming systems, they have so low yields because they don't have access to conventional inputs, and they don't have the money to buy expensive pesticides and fertilizers, chemical fertilizers. While some of these farming systems, they have a lot of labor available, and some of these farming systems, they also have animal manure available. If these farmers learned organic methods, organic composting methods, organic pest control methods, we could provide a very easy way of increasing yields in these small-scale farming systems. So because these farmers don't have access to chemical inputs, I think organic agriculture could provide an opportunity to intensify their systems.
Are there any further questions? No? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the speakers for an excellent presentation and response to questions. Thank you very much.